Hello and welcome to the Andrew Hines Real Estate Investing Podcast. I am your host back here for another midweek episode. And in case you missed last week, the point of these midweek episodes is really to do a catch up, to talk about those things that I don't really get to talk about on the regular episodes. I'm always very to business on the regular episodes, introducing my guests and getting into what it is they talk about, making the announcements. And it feels so rigid that I really just wanted an avenue where I could do a uncluttered, very relaxed, off the cuff, unedited talk. And that's really what this is. So what you can expect out of these is updates on my life, updates on what I'm working on, my philosophies and beliefs about certain things surrounding business and real estate, economics and how that all plays together and decisions that need to be made. And so this week, I had a few things that I was going to talk about. I'll pull my list up over here so I can talk about them. I want to go over the day in the life, what I'm doing right now, what I'm doing with the Florida deals. I actually locked a property up, so in Orange Grove, 35 acres, somewhat east of Tampa, and this is something that we were able to acquire. So Matt Pichet and I are working on this endeavor together with our team, and we were able to acquire this one using our cold call center. So a call was made, we got a call back, and we negotiated with the seller. I think there's quite a bit of meat on the bone in this one, so I'm not going to give the specifics because it's not a finalized sale yet. But we like the deal. It's given a positive feeling in terms of what we're doing, and hey, we're on the right track. We're 5 days into our first cold call campaign, and we're seeing success. And this is the wholesale model, or for us, more of a wholetail, in that we're not looking to wholesale these deals to other people necessarily, although down the road that's certainly a possibility. We're looking to actually close these properties ourselves, buy from motivated sellers, people who just don't want to deal with it. And of course, that's a numbers game because a lot of people do not fit into that category and would happily list. But we're going after that type. And obviously, that means hitting a lot of people, getting a lot of no's, and then getting to the ones that say yes. So I don't personally want to make those calls myself, but fortunately, with the way the world works these days, you can hire these jobs out, which I think is fantastic. I also wanted to talk more specifically about what it is that we're going to be continuing to do. So Matt and I have started the wheel in motion, so to speak, but we're bringing on another caller. We're actually going to be calling on houses in Cape Coral and throughout the rest of Florida who are in foreclosure situations. So if you watched the last week's episode, 265B, I talked about how you can pull lists and you can skip trace those lists, meaning get all their information, get their phone numbers, their addresses, although that's all pretty much easily accessible public information through even just the county website when you do the tax roll lookup. And so you get all their information and then scrub off any known litigators, anything like that, and start calling them. And so the next campaign is going after people who are pre-foreclosure, which means they've been given the notice by the bank. They're not yet at the auction stage, so they could still technically redeem their houses. And we're going to just start calling them. So our lists, in terms of number of people who are on a list to be called, are usually around 10 to 12,000. And our cold call center is making a lot of dials a day to get through those 10,000. And of course, out of that, we're not going to get anywhere near that many leads. But that's just a list that we start with. And then it's up to us, of course. And I look at this as a numbers game, like all the rest of it. It's just in this case, they're all going to be motivated sellers. So how many leads would really be needed in order to make it worthwhile? Only one, of course. If we can close one deal from one campaign, we're more than happy. More than pays for itself. But maybe there's more than that. How many do we need to speak with in order to get a deal? I really don't know. It's a total experiment. So one of the things I love working with Matt for is that, you know, he's full of that fire, right? Go, 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 let's do it. He's got a ton of experience in this, and he's seen how the numbers play out on these large marketing spends. Like, Matt has been open about spending, you know, $30,000 to acquire a lead. And from the looks of it, we'll be way under that down here so far. So even on our first cold calling campaign, like, we're incredibly under that, like not even in the same ballpark, like closer to like 10% of that. So it's definitely promising. And then of course anything beyond that's gravy. One thing I've noted with our land caller, you know, we're calling for land, that campaign, we've had a lot of people say, yeah, I'd be interested in selling, and then for one reason or another, it's not a great fit. So we pulled about, I think it was 33 or 32 leads in the first 5 days, and it's a 4 week campaign, so 4 or 5 day weeks, so 20 days of calling. So one quarter of the way into that campaign, that was the deal we locked up. And I'm hoping for many more, but we'll see what we get. And you know, definitely exciting to just be moving and playing big. You know, and it's not something I've done a lot of. I mean, it's debatable, right? I mean, of course, obviously, there's people who would look at what I've done and say, "Wow, that's incredible." And I definitely think I've been part of some cool stuff. And a big part of being able to be part of that stuff was working with really cool people. And I'm not taking credit for it. But anyways, all right. So there's a couple other things, and just seeing my time here, because I don't want to make these super long. But yeah, I'll go ahead and give an update on the camp. So just in case you haven't been following me, or you're not familiar with what I've been up to. So I started out as a student rental investor. Well, I didn't start that way. I bought some single family homes and I invested in the US. And then I really hit my stride in 2015 when I started doing value add student rentals with additions and partial guts and all that stuff, and making sort of a turnkey product. And when the market kind of shifted, I really didn't like it anymore, because I felt like it wasn't real estate that played well for, you know, families to live in. And obviously hindsight's 2020. I'm not going to get into that. It's a story for another day. But it ultimately led me to want to look at the US more for the second time, because I invested the first time in 2012. But it also led me to want to get into hospitality, Airbnb, because I saw cash flow. And when I saw that people were you know, doing so well during the lockdowns, in the summer of the lockdowns, the first summer of them, making so much money on a weekly rate, it really made me think about the next step in going into hospitality. So over the next couple of years, I liquidated my portfolio of student rentals and family rentals, and I did buy a campsite, and then we've more recently bought a resort, a hospitality resort in Tobermory. So camp and hospitality resort, like cottage resort on the waterfront in Tobermory, separated by about 20 minutes. They're not right side by side. So I bought those two locations with a group of partners, and they're both huge value add business plays. And with the camp, we turned it into a glamping facility. So when we got it, it was a bunch of, you know, seasonal trailers, and it was the anything goes campground. So partiers, huge groups, just absolutely overrun, over capacity. But that was the norm. And I guess the previous owner, you know, just saw that as the way to optimize the revenue it could earn. And we came in and we managed to, you know, cut that traffic probably at least in half. Got rid of all the seasonals, and I say that, you know, understanding that obviously was upsetting to these seasonals who wanted to come back, but we just couldn't justify what we paid for the site and having people rent an area for $2,000 a season when we know an Airbnb could do that in a week. So that was really the big driving decision there. So we had to have a lot of conversations, a lot of hard conversations, asking them politely, or, you know, when they could get off the site is pretty much the conversation. Say, unfortunately, we can't renew. You know, so that all played out. We had to deal with the fact that we had people coming back from previous seasons who had experienced the anything goes environment, and we had a big fallout from that. It was operationally tough, but it's been getting better and better. And this past season was fantastic. I think the neighbors are really starting to like us, because, you know, things are better. And we're actually on track to be profitable this year if we maintain our growth. So we went from ballpark 240 sales in our first year, up from I think 180 the previous owner had, but he had a restaurant contributing. We shut the restaurant down. We cut back on the regular camping significantly and still managed to increase sales. And then we've increased them again over 400,000 this past year. So we're experiencing the growth. We're seeing, you know, the desire for it, but it's just that the challenge with this is the private money, the operations. It's not just real estate. It's a business with real estate attached. So finally, in year three, we are projecting to be profitable, and we're super excited about that. Hospitality resort, the cottage resort, that's a different story. That one is a development play. We are going to be building cottages on that site. It's just under 9 acres on the water, Lake Huron, in Tobermory proper. And I see a huge opportunity there. So we're as of right zoning for cottages. So that's what we're doing. But now to bring this all back around, because I don't want this to be too long. We are just really gearing up right now. We're actually going to be bringing in equity partners. So we're presently talking to a company that will help us with our raises, because we want to bring in the money to do the expansions the way they need to be done, to really optimize what these sites can be. So our glamping concept is proven. It's worked great. We've had tents that have done, you know, $24,000 in a season, which is absolutely absurd when you think about the fact that it's canvas on a deck. So we know that concept is proven. And the big thing that's really stopped us from taking that to the next level is putting the amenities on site needed to keep people there. So right now we've been the central hub for people who want to explore the area, which really only requires a couple of days. But if we could be the central hub and have amenities on site, perhaps we could extend those stays by a couple of days. That greatly decreases the strain on our staff, facilities, for turnovers and things of that nature. But it also it essentially increases our demand, because now each person staying longer, they effectively reduce the supply of nights we have available, which gives us the ability to potentially raise prices. So that's part of the thinking. And there are layers on layers on this. I could probably talk to you for hours about the things I think about this. It's fun. We get to be creative with this. And if you haven't seen it, I highly recommend you check out grottogetaway.com or on Instagram at the Grotto Getaway Glamp to see some of the really, really cool media we've had done up. And just an idea of what we're going to be adding in. We're in, and I don't know our time frame on this. Like, I know what we want to do. However, what actually happens and when it is available, time will tell. But we're planning on we're planning on adding in a cold plunge, sauna, hot tub, and a container pool, and potentially, and we haven't run this by the landscape architect yet, but we're going to get it designed to have a pickleball court as well. So we really want to just make it a sort of a destination spot within a destination area, which is sort of the grand slam as far as I can surmise. And I could be wrong. I don't think I am. We've looked at a lot of other areas, and we've looked at what's working for different sites, and having what people want on site is huge. Right now, we really, really appeal to the people who just want peaceful, but you only need to stay so many days at a place like that, especially if you're in a tent. Of course, our trailer stays, they can stay longer because, you know, they got a running water and a bathroom on their trailer and, you know, a few more of the comforts of home. And then, of course, we've got our cottage resort, which we run sort of the similar season. We're going to open a little bit earlier in May, and then we run that until October, mid-October, end of October at the latest. So that's sort of our running season. Our camp is about May 10th-ish to October 15th every year. So just in case you're planning to stay, grottogetaway.com, you can book your glamping stay. All right, now shifting gears one more time. So the other thing I wanted to talk about, and this is just a tangent but a random thought, and there's just been so much hype around it because it's gone crazy, is Bitcoin. So I've been a bit of a contrarian to many of my friends, colleagues, followers, because so many people, including like my business partners, love Bitcoin. And I'm the guy who has opposed it from the very beginning. Not that I don't think you can make a lot of money from it. I'm not giving any financial advice here. I'm just saying what I see. So I see something that obviously is going up and is probably going to continue to go up for the near future. could be even for a longer term, as some regulations come in around it, you know, taxation, being taxed on income in Bitcoin, all that stuff. Like, the system is obviously allowing it. If politicians really had an issue, they'd be shutting it down. They'd find a way. And I know Bitcoiners will argue that you can't do that, but that's a long expanded debate, which probably don't have time for here. But here's what I do want to say. I'm happy for you if you've invested, if you've made money for it, from it. I'm happy for you that's the case. I know some people who have made a lot of money off of this recent bull run, and I think that's great for you. I think that take the win. I don't know when it potentially shifts or changes again. As we've seen historically, it is extremely volatile. One day it's up, the next day it's down. It's had major crashes and major spikes. So it's hard to predict. I think the people who are going to make the most money from it are going to be the ones that have been invested on a longer term basis. They were not emotional about it. And then the ones that are bandwagoning on as it's going up, I don't think that they're has likely to be profitable in it. So why do I bring this up? I bring it up, well, mainly because it's on people's mind right now. And I think we've kind of hit a point where it's like, to oppose it, you're kind of looked at as you're ridiculous. And I'm not saying I oppose it. I just don't. I think that what Bitcoin ultimately does is replace one fiction, which is fiat currency, which is just fiction. It's an idea. I mean, yeah, you could say the paper's physical, but the paper's next to worthless. With another fiat fictional idea. Yes, it's a scarce fiction because it was designed to be a scarce fiction. It's limited at 21 million Bitcoin. But the issue with that false scarcity is people call it a store of value. It's not a currency because you can't really transact with it very well. It uses a lot of energy to transact. And we can see from history that it's not really ever been used that way. So people say it's been used as a store of value, but it's not really a store of value. I wrote this down. Here's my best statement so far with the brief few minutes I thought about it, that describes what I think Bitcoin is. And this is my opinion, but I don't think it's a store of value. I think it's an outcome of aggregate belief. So in other words, Bitcoin's value is entirely derived by the cumulative beliefs of the market, which drive their decision to buy something that when I first heard about it, I kind of laughed a little. I'm like, that's insane. Because I'm, you know, a guy who graduated from business school, had studied economics. I'm like, well, hang on. Like, what's honest money? And then what's this? Like, honest money in my mind is gold and silver. Gold and silver, you can go back in history and see that their buying power has remained pretty much the same regardless of what's happened to currency. But with Bitcoin, you can't say that. Like, it's changed in its buying power significantly, and it's got that volatility. Now, granted, there are a number of factors, and there are probably some out there who study up on all the trends and all the things around it, and they know that they can make money with it. My hat's off to you. I'm not saying don't use it to make money if you feel that you know what you're doing and you can. That's totally your call. I wouldn't, but that doesn't mean I'm right in that regard. There are probably many other people who would agree with my stance on it and still use it to make money, and that's totally fine. You do what makes sense to you. I'm just giving you my take. It's just, if we're making decisions and getting religious about Bitcoin, and I feel like some people are, oh, you've got to read the book or you're just not getting it. No, it should be simple to explain. It should. The centralized information with Bitcoin, I know that's advertised as a positive, but every single node or every single computer and system on their network needs to agree about every transaction, which means ultimately every single wallet is identified and it is identifiable. And maybe they don't have your name attached to it, but I mean, there's ways. So it's 2024. There's ways they can find who owns which wallet. And then of course you could have people lose their wallet. But here's a good question. It takes electricity, massive amounts of electricity to verify transactions, right? And that's how people mine Bitcoin, by verifying transactions. What happens in 2042 or whenever, when they're done mining, and every last Bitcoin has been mined, you have 21 million. Who will power that network? What will happen at that point? And I don't know. I'm asking, you know, and again, going back to this, I've just thrown out some thoughts. I'm, again, very happy for you if you've made money from it. Very happy for you if that works for you. I just think as a long-term play, for me, I want to be in something that's real. So real estate, obviously, is I can touch it. It's tangible. I want to pour energy into things that are real. And if that means converting my energy, my work, my efforts into buying gold coins, that's cool too. I haven't bought any gold in a while. By no means have a big collection. I have some silver, I have some gold. I like those. I think that, you know, generally they've sort of kept up with inflation, you know, not so much in the last few years, but you'll see it over time. They do keep up. And that really shows you how your buying power is eroding, because I heard Stefan Arnio say in one of his talks way back when that, you know, back in like the 1920s, a steak dinner, and what was it? You could take an ounce of gold and buy a steak dinner and a custom-made suit. And in 2020, you could buy a steak dinner and a custom-made suit for that same ounce of gold. So its buying power stayed the same. That's the big thing that I have as a takeaway there, is that, you know, that's not an investment, so to speak. It's not gonna make you wealthy. It's just something that preserves buying power. That's it. So I think gold's a pain. I've actually had some stolen from me. Super frustrating. You know, what good is it then? You know, the same thing could happen with Bitcoin, you know, hard wallets and things like that. That could happen too, but you can have ways of getting them back. So it's not to say that I don't think Bitcoin has some great tech that could be really useful for a lot of different things. I just don't see it as what a lot of people see it as. So hopefully I didn't ruffle too many feathers there. I just wanted to share my thoughts, because this is the Random Thoughts show now, in addition to being the main primary podcast. These Wednesdays and Thursday episodes are really just about throwing some ideas out there, sharing what I'm up to, and I'll welcome your feedback. Definitely interested. I'm not interested in getting into any huge debates about Bitcoin, but I mean, of course, if you have some thoughts, no problem. Let's just keep it respectful. I respect a ton of people who invest in that and use it for their wealth, and no problem there. But anyways, guys, if you want to reach out and connect, let me know your thoughts, or just introduce yourself. Instagram's probably the best place for that. Or if you're on my mailing list, which you can do through my website, you can just reply to one of the emails you receive. And I'll look forward to connecting with you further. And I will talk to you very soon.